Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday afternoon. We had anticipated a good deal of political talk with our guest this hour, Professor Julian Zelizer, but then riots broke out in Baltimore, and a piece that Julian wrote in January reflecting on racial conflict in Ferguson and many years ago in Watts seemed to be the best place for us to start our conversation this hour, and it will start in just a little while. The piece is a 1965 failure that still haunts America. We'll also cover today's same-sex marriage oral arguments before the Supreme Court, ask whether the Democratic Party needs Wall Street more than it needs to take a stand against Wall Street, and whether there will ever be reform of the campaign finance system. Professor Julian Zelizer will be joining us, and we'll be welcoming your phone calls very shortly. This is also, we have a busy hour, the Wisconsin Public Radio Spring Membership Drive. And we know that you count on this network for talk about the issues that I just discussed and all of the issues that matter to you. And we count on you to keep all of those issues on the air. So give this hour, WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
Last hour, we heard from 11 listeners. Thank you so much for those pledges. This hour, we have a goal of 46 pledges. And these hourly goals are important. They help us stay on track financially so we can keep the discussions going on Wisconsin Public Radio. Take a moment right now and give at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
You know that what happens in the rest of the world matters to us. What's going on in Washington, D.C., in the Supreme Court, what's happening in Baltimore. It's why WPR is so important. What's happening in Wisconsin? We talk with experts in all kinds of fields from all over.
We get the news from around the world, from Wisconsin, and right down to our own neighborhood. And because you value being an informed citizen, make a pledge to the station that helps keep you connected to the world at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
And you decide the amount of your pledge. Every pledge matters. Every pledge helps pay for the programs that you enjoy on Wisconsin Public Radio. During this drive, you can ask for the 2015 WPR Artist Mug when you give $150 or more. Lisa will tell you more about that.
That's right. It's the fourth mug in our annual Artist Mug series. It's designed by Nick Robleski, who's an award-winning woodcart artist from the Driftless region of Wisconsin. The artwork on this mug, it's a peaceful scene of two swans kind of gliding through a starry night sky. So ask for your mug when you give $12.50 a month. That's $150 or more at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
I like the idea of being able to call in or hear other people's call-ins. I think some of the shows on public radio that got me asking, wait a minute, and suddenly I had a political awakening. My name is Ray from Eau Claire, and when I hear a program featuring a new author or a new book on WPR, it puts me first in line to run to our library to get that new book.
Go to WPR.org, 888-202-2552 to make your pledge during our spring membership drive. I'm Kathleen Dunn. Lisa Nalbandian is with me, and we are asking for your support of WPR. Your gift, whatever it might be, $10 or $15 a month, is the correct amount.
We live in a generous society. We're quick to help a friend or a neighbor in need, and we chip in for good causes.
So we ask you to continue that tradition of a generous society when you support WPR right now. If you've never given to WPR before, why don't you become our next new member at WPR.org, 888-202-2552. Many new members give $5 a month, but the amount, of course, is totally up to you.
There's, I'm sure, a lot of reasons why you listen to Wisconsin Public Radio. But maybe one of the big reasons that you tune into the Ideas Network is because you appreciate civil discourse. You value respect, even when people disagree.
And you like news, talk, entertainment that appeal to your better nature. You get that all the time on WPR. So support what you value and donate now at WPR.org, 888-202-2552.
Giving takes just a few minutes of your time. You'll tell us your name, contact information, how much you want to give, and how you'd like to pay. You can give in one lump sum, or even better, you can become a monthly sustainer. No matter how you choose to give or how much you give, use the next few minutes to support the station you count on at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
As we well know, time goes by very quickly, and maybe it's been longer than you realize since you last gave to WPR. We're asking you to keep your membership active.
That's right. And you know, you could think about your support of Wisconsin Public Radio like you think of other services that you rely on and pay for, maybe your internet or your phone bill. Renew your support of WPR right now with an ongoing monthly gift at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
And we're looking, Lisa, for what, 46 pledges
That's
during
right.
this hour in the next, you know, I don't know.
46 minutes.
Thank you. 46 minutes. So your pledge right now during this spring membership drive is an important one.
And also for this drive only, you can ask for the fourth annual WPR Artist Mug, designed by Wisconsin artist Nick Robleski. It's a beautiful design, and the mug is made in the USA. It's yours for a pledge of $12.50 a month. That's $150 or more per year at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
If you're not a sustainer, please become one right now. It's very easy to set up convenient, ongoing monthly donations from your bank account or your credit card at WPR.org. 888-202-2552.
And Mark from Monona says, thank you for being a reliable news source that also explores emerging issues. And if that doesn't capture this show, I don't know what does.
Yeah, we'll
thank you, Mark.
We'll be on those emerging issues in one moment. Your pledge right now is very important. That's why we're asking you for it. WPR.org, 888-202-2552. And, of course, thank you very much. Thank you, Lisa.
Thank you.
Professor Julian Zelizer is joining us now. He has been a guest on our program quite frequently. He's a professor of history at Princeton University, and he has written all kinds of presidential history books. His latest book on LBJ, he writes prolifically for CNN, and you see him on television quite frequently. A piece that he wrote, I thought we would start, because of all that's been going on in Baltimore, I thought we would start with Baltimore this hour. And it's interesting because he wrote this really kind of heartbreaking piece on what happened in Watts in 1965, a failure that still haunts us. He writes, and you could say the very same thing about what has been going on in Baltimore, particularly last night. Many community residents in Watts didn't trust the police. Charges of brutality commonplace for decades in that community. Police arrested a brother and a mother. An angry crowd started to throw bottles and rocks. Rioting quickly spread through a 25-block area. One 5-year-old boy was killed by sniper fire. Fire riots continued for 6 days, with 34 people killed and hundreds injured, and the National Guard called in to help restore order. This was in 1965. And, of course, in Baltimore last night, the National Guard was called in. Thousands of police from surrounding communities were asked to be there. The president today, during his press conference, asked for an understanding of what was happening here and highlighted the really strained relationship between police and minority communities, obviously, in places all over the country. So that is where we will be starting this hour of our program. Professor Julian Zelizer, always a pleasure to speak with you, sir. Hello.
Thanks for having me.
You know, I read that your 1965 reflections on that, which you wrote in January, reflecting on Ferguson, and I thought, oh my gosh, it's the same set of concerns. It's the same kind of rioting that we saw so many years ago in Watts.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, we saw it in Watts, Newark, New Jersey, Detroit, Michigan, and many other places, including Baltimore, during the second half of the 1960s. And what's really heartbreaking is that the riots often revolved around the same issues that we're discussing today, including police brutality and harassment. So it's a set of questions at the heart of the rioting that has continued for many decades now.
I was interested in, because I come from a baseball family, but some of these comments from people with the Baltimore Orioles I thought were interesting. The center fielder, Adam Jones, said this, and I'd like your response. An African American is an African American. The injustice of police violence and surveillance, the targeting of poor and primarily minority communities as means of government revenue, the deep segregation of and lack of economic opportunity that pervade urban and, again, primarily minority communities most perniciously, and other issues that have received more attention throughout these demonstrations are not new problems facing the country or its cities. And then we go to what the president said, but we need soul searching in wake of what's been happening in Baltimore. Well, we've needed soul searching for a heck of a long time. When are we going to get serious soul searching and some changes? I thought what Adam had to say was right on, right on.
Yeah, and in a city like Baltimore, I think residents of that city understand the kind of racial segregation that exists there. It's very stark, not just racial segregation, but economic segregation. And so you have very impoverished areas with high levels of African Americans living in these communities where these problems have been common. And so what you see, as you saw in the 1960s, was that a riot that revolves around one incident, it really emerges because of the pent-up frustration that has existed with ongoing problems related to this. Unfortunately, in the 1960s, the rioting certainly didn't result in the government taking many proactive steps to try to deal with the issues. In fact, it went the opposite way. The rioting from 1965 onward helped to fuel a conservative backlash toward programs to deal with urban America. And so I don't know what's going to happen right now, but at least back in those decades, the response was very different than trying to actually solve the issues at hand.
And are we trying in some ways to solve the issues by placing more emphasis, at least we're talking about it more and more on the air, more emphasis on the issue of those who have and those who have not? It seems to be finding its way into Democratic conversations and Republican conversations during this long, long election season, that we need to look at that disparity, and this is an outgrowth in some ways of that disparity.
There is. I mean, I think there's very specific issues that have emerged about policing that in some ways don't require the macro discussion about inequality in America. So the treatment of these cases by grand juries, the issue of body cameras, training police in different ways to handle these moments in much better fashion, those are all specific areas of policy that I think could probably be addressed without a presidential campaign and without a huge mobilization. Those are front and center right now, and there's discussions going on about how can we get better policing on this front.
Mm-hmm.
The bigger question, it's true, and certainly what's been going on in Baltimore deals with some of the economic inequality issues that Democrats are hoping at least get on the campaign trail, and some Republicans are speaking about as well. So it's important to deal with the specifics, but I think over the long term, you'll never have cities, inner cities, that are stronger, that are more vibrant, where the communities are in better shape, unless you deal with these bigger economic questions.
Well, it seems to me as though you have to have a much quicker response to an event that took place that left this 25-year-old African-American young man with his spine severed, dying in police custody, and not getting much of an explanation many days later as to what happened.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. I think a lot of the cases that we've seen in the past year, the response has been as big an issue as the actual incident. So everyone is horrified by the incident. Everyone is troubled by how this could happen. I think there is not consensus, but there's a lot of support for the idea this shouldn't happen. I think what a lot of this has come from is the way in which the situation has been handled, either a lack of information about what went on, a feeling that the police authorities and the government authorities aren't really interested in investigating, and if there was wrongdoing by the police, prosecuting. And so I think that's at the heart of what we're talking about. You know, how do local officials and the courts respond when there is evidence and and data that the situation went poorly.
Mm-hmm. And finally, on this issue, although we'll invite our listeners to call in with their thoughts about it, I thought this was an interesting comment from a woman named Del Conley, a Baltimore resident who's been involved, not violently, but in some of the protests. She said, "People who don't live in my neighborhood or don't come from the same background as me or the same area as me, they don't know how we live. They're outsiders looking in. They don't know what's going on. They don't know what we go through. They don't know anything. If you ask me, I think there's a good element of truth in that, and I wonder how we get to know some things. How do we be more than outsiders looking in?"
Well, you know, I think it's true, and it's not true. So I do think a lot of comments are made on all sides of the spectrum about what's going on by people who don't have a good feel for the communities that are being discussed, who make assumptions about, you know, what's happening in the community, what the accused person did, what the police did, without really knowing the facts. And that is a difficult part of how politicians have to deal with this. But, you know, local government, to begin with, can quickly amass data in this day and age. I mean, the local governments have gone through revolutions in collecting all kinds of information on all the issues that go on in a city because of computer technology and other mechanisms, and they need to do the same to really make this problem of policing front and center, not only for the benefit of the community residents, but for the police themselves, so we have a stronger police force that doesn't have these problems. And so it does have to start at the local level, but then there's going to be room for the Justice Department to keep probing and proactively trying to stop these situations before they take place.
Mm-hmm. Are you worried that we're going to see shades of 1965 in the summer of 2015?
Well, yeah, I mean, the immediate concern when you see the riots is not just the riots taking place, but that they will spread. And this happened again and again in the 60s. It happened after Martin Luther King's assassination as well in 1968, where it went to many cities and went out of control, and many people took advantage of the riots. It wasn't simply political protest. It was then, you know, criminality and
sure.
Loot as well. And so that's always the fear. It seems, at least for now, it's contained, but my guess is this is a day-by-day situation to see what, again, is the response to what happened to him.
We're going to welcome phone calls. Professor Julian Zelizer is our guest this hour, talking about Baltimore. We're going to be talking about the Supreme Court hearing oral arguments on same-sex marriage. Today, they heard those. We'll be talking about the issue of inequality and how it may be a part of presidential campaign. He wrote an interesting piece asking whether Hillary Clinton and the Democrats can really take on Wall Street, and will anybody really take on campaign finance reform? So those are a few of the areas that we will go into as we continue. He is professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University and is the author of lots of books, including The Fierce Urgency of Now, Lyndon Johnson, Congress, and the Battle for the Great Society. He's a regular political contributor to CNN.com. Our number is 800-486-8655, and we'll be with you in a moment. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We'll start taking calls for Professor Julian Zelizer in just one moment. Lisa Nalbandian is joining me in our studios here in Milwaukee, and this is, we want to let you know, our spring membership drive. I know you rely on WPR for informative, in-depth discussions, a chance for all of us to respond to large news in the country. We rely on you to keep these discussions going strong. So your gift right now of any amount will make a difference. WPR.org 888-202-2552.
We have about 35 minutes left in the hour, and we're looking for 40 more pledges. Make your donation right now. Support the programs you enjoy and rely on at WPR.org or 888-202-2552. 800-282-5552.
It's hard to find a place for meaningful, substantial, respectful conversations, and that's why you listen to Wisconsin Public Radio and to this program. We really do sink our teeth into important topics.
Whether it's interviews we recently did with Wisconsin veterans or historical topics, national politics, or international news that isn't getting enough attention elsewhere, you can get the information that you need right here. This kind of substance is only possible. It's only possible with your support. Make your contribution right now at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
During this membership drive, you can get the fourth annual WPR Artist Mug when you give $12.50 a month. That's $150 or more. Your donation will support the programs that you count on, and you can also get this beautiful mug.
The mug is USA-made, featuring a design by award-winning Wisconsin artist Nick Robleski. It's a woodcut print with two swans soaring through a starry night sky. Check out that design and ask for yours now when you pledge at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
I know you enjoy listening to Wisconsin Public Radio in part because we don't have any commercials, and it means that we depend on other sources of funding. State and federal and corporate funding are very important.
But the single largest piece of the budget comes from you. Your support makes such a difference. It's the backbone of our funding. Make your pledge now at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
Your call is important to us, so please leave a message after the beep.
I enjoy your programs. What I enjoy most about it is, you know, I'm born in Milwaukee. I have an urban point of view of things. When I listen to your callers calling throughout the states, I have all kinds of points of view from a rural, farm, you name it. I just like to hear the points of view through the state, and I enjoy and I learn from the other callers.
Make your donation in support of the programs you count on. WPR.org, 888-202-2552. I'm Kathleen Dunn with Lisa Nalbandian, asking for your gift to listener-supported Wisconsin Public Radio during our spring membership drive. Your pledge might be, I don't know, $5 a month or maybe $100 a month. We appreciate and count on your gift.
One common factor among WPR listeners is that they love to read. You probably have gotten a lot of book recommendations from your WPR listening, whether it's a book on chapter a day or an interview with an author or something you heard on a news program that made you want to go out and learn more about that topic.
I know your WPR listening leads to a never-ending book list. I have in my house books in our desk. Oh, I'm going to finish all of that. Here's a book that came in. I know we can't do a show, but I'm going to read that book. We read all the time, and your donation right now makes our exploring all of those books an endless kind of enjoyment and discovery. It makes all of that possible. So give now at WPR.org, 888-202-2552 to keep the book recommendations coming.
When you give today, think about becoming a sustainer. As a sustaining member, you'll give a monthly amount, maybe $10 or $15 a month, that will automatically come out of your bank account or credit card. Your monthly gift will continue until you ask us to make a change.
This means we can depend on you the way you depend on us, day in, day out, year in and year out, and you're in control. You can change your giving at any time. It's a convenient way to give. It's really helpful to WPR. So become a sustainer right now, WPR.org, 888-202-2552.
A $10 a month contribution to Wisconsin Public Radio is just over 30 cents a day. And you probably spend a lot more than 30 cents a day on things you value a lot less than WPR.
Yes, so spend a little right now and you'll get a lot in return. Join, renew, make an extra gift at WPR.org, 888-202-2552.
Wisconsin legislators are busy planning the state budget for the next 2 years, and there's a debate about the level of funding for Wisconsin public broadcasting. As proposed, the budget would result in a $3 million annual cut in state support for public broadcasting, and that funding has been essential to delivering programs throughout the state.
Wisconsin Public Broadcasting is working very hard to address the challenge as the budget process goes forward, and listener support continues to be a vital part of the WPR budget. Your donation is important. It's more important than ever, really. WPR.org, 888-202-2552.
We have about 40 pledges to go, Kathleen, and about another half hour to get them. So your gift right now at WPR.org or 888-202-2552 really, really helps.
And this pledge drive, show your support, get the latest WPR artist mug, USA-made mug designed by Wisconsin artist Nick Robleski. It's yours for a pledge of $12.50 a month. It's $150. WPR.org, 888-202-2552.
If you're a sustaining member, thank you so much. Make today the day you increase your support of WPR by $5 a month or whatever amount you choose at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
And I know many of you feel like Clint from La Crosse, who says, I love you guys. I enjoy the talk radio very much. And he spends many cars and many hours in his car each week. It really is. It's great for trips. It is, yeah.
Definitely. So your pledge right now makes a difference during this spring membership drive at WPR.org or 888-202-2552. And thank you.
Yeah, thanks so much. Professor Julian Zelizer is our guest. We have a lot to talk about. We're looking at breaking news from Baltimore. We're talking about, we'll get to the Supreme Court, but we have a full bank of phone lines with people wanting to talk about what's been going on in Baltimore. So let's go to your phone calls before we move on to the Supreme Court and then to Wall Street and then to campaign finance reform. Ray in Milwaukee, thanks for waiting. Hi.
Yeah, I've been listening since Tom Clark was on there. This is definitely one of the best programs in the nation, and I hope people do donate.
Thanks, Ray.
So, I called in this morning, Tom Ashbrook on Point had an excellent show about what's going on in Baltimore. And I just wanted to bring up Milwaukee is probably more segregated than even Baltimore, and we have issues as hot and as ready to explode in this city as any other city in the United States. Now, I've been calling my alderman for the last 2 years, who is Nick Kovac on the east side of Milwaukee. We see millions and millions and millions of dollars being poured into the east side of Milwaukee to build condos, light rail, you name it, they're pouring it in this side. And I suggested to Nick, which, by the way, he has never called me back on these issues. It's just dead silence from our alder people. I said every project that's done on Milwaukee's east side, there should be a sister project in the inner city. Let's rebuild swimming pools. Let's redo the sports, you know, so kids have a place to go during the summer that's safe. Mm-hmm. And if we don't do this, I guarantee you this is coming to Milwaukee. No.
Thank you, Ray, very much for your call. Why is it so hard to bring businesses? Obviously, jobs is a huge part of this, Professor Zelizer. And the president mentioned this, too. We need to develop our inner cities. We need to bring industries back to central cities. So why don't we do that?
Well, you know, the main reason is the, you know, political support for that is just weak. So these are communities which, by definition, don't have a lot of political clout. And so urban policy since the 1960s has not been about revitalizing inner-city America for the residents of those cities, but about gentrification and trying to shore up areas like I imagine the caller was talking about, that bring in suburban, upper-middle-class residents back
right
into the cities. And so there's many programs that are proposed in cities like Detroit right now. There are efforts to not only bring back jobs, but to create new kind of banking programs to bring loans and capital to lower- and middle-income communities, to provide better educational opportunities. There's a wide array of ideas. But the, you know, political strength of the poor isn't good. And so, again, urban policy has gone in a very different direction.
Right. We'll take more phone calls on this, but I was interested in your thoughts on today's oral arguments on same-sex marriage before the Supreme Court. Did you get any sense of where they're going on this or not?
You know, I've learned enough from following this never to read into the arguments. You know, it appears the court is divided. It appears that it's still likely the court will move in a positive direction in terms of legitimating same-sex marriage and challenging these state restrictions that still exist. But I don't know at this point, and I think to speculate, isn't helpful in some ways. But it is a historic moment. It's the final moment. It's the culmination of what's been a very rapid social revolution.
Mm-hmm.
That's a contrast to what we're talking about with racial progress in terms of how quickly the old norms and the old social mores have fallen away.
Let's go to Casey in Waukesha. Hi, Casey.
Hi. I just had a quick question for the guest, seeing that he has so much history on, and there's so much of the history on LBJ. There's actually a really good documentary that goes over the Kennedy assassination called Dark Legacy, and it gets into how the Bush family had their connections to the assassination of Kennedy. And
I think you're pretty much off base on that. Do you have any questions that it was a conspiracy, that it was somebody other than Lee Harvey Oswald?
I'm not in that camp.
Right.
And,
I didn't think you were.
Yeah.
All right. Democratic Party, let's talk about Wall Street for a moment, needs Wall Street more than it needs to take a stand against Wall Street. You wrote a really interesting piece about, you know, how tied they are and the Republicans are. We're going to look at another election that's billions of dollars. It blows my mind. Billions of dollars to run for president. And I don't know, is there any serious talk about reforming the campaign finance system?
There'll be talk about it, but the chances it will happen are minimal. And, you know, what we've seen in the last decade is a steady erosion of the Watergate campaign finance system that was put into place in response to that scandal. Both parties have rejected the system that we had for a while, where candidates took public money in exchange for limiting the amount of contributions they could have. And we've seen all kinds of loopholes open up. And the emergence of these new super PACs, which are pretty devastating, I think, to the strength of the democratic process. And that, combined with the congressional campaign finance system, gives a lot of powerful interest quick access. And it makes discussions of dealing with inequality or dealing with reform on Wall Street, you know, great campaign rhetoric, but the odds of anything happening are slim to none because of the way our system works. So it's a problem that always gets put aside unless there's a big scandal. We tend to focus on bread and butter issues instead of reform. But in fact, reform is at the heart of whether you can deal with these policy questions we're discussing.
Can you, as the inevitable Democratic nominee Hillary Clinton has done, take on the issue of how expensive campaigns are and have a campaign that's going to be $2.5 billion, maybe even more than that, and call for campaign finance reform at the same time? Does that ring true or not?
It doesn't. You can do it, and candidates do it, but I think many voters are cynical about this issue, and that's part of why they don't, you know, place a lot of emphasis on it. Voters are rational in that way. I think they understandably see how the system works, and when they hear let's reform the system, they're just dubious that it will ever work. And President Obama himself, you know, he ran on this issue in 2008. He really argued, if you look at his rhetoric, that without reforming campaign finance, he won't be able to change the way Washington works. And he put it aside pretty quickly. And so I do think there's a kind of cynicism about the issue, which then has the effect of making it harder to build a political coalition behind it.
Mm-hmm. And what about the issue of economic inequality? You wrote in one of your pieces that we've got former Maryland Governor Martin O'Malley, who doesn't seem to be gaining a lot of traction in this race, trying to steal Clinton's thunder by talking about disproportionate wealth. We, of course, have Elizabeth Warren on this issue pretty genuinely for quite some time. But then we have Chuck Schumer coming in, replacing Harry Reid as leader of the Senate Democrats. And so the leadership of the party isn't likely to be talking about issues of disproportionate wealth and have closer ties to Wall Street.
Yeah, I mean, and this is a disconnect, meaning I think there are a lot of Democrats, including political strategists, who understand that the issue of inequality, the issue of middle-class security, is one that actually resonates with voters. This matters very much. And it can be a winning issue. You even hear Republicans talking more about it. I just heard Governor Kasich of Ohio speaking, and this was really his main theme. But the problem is, you know, once people are in office, there are just few incentives for taking the steps that are needed to deal with inequality and to shore up the middle class. And Democrats have a problem. There was an era where Democrats, the biggest power in the Democratic Party were the unions between the 30s and 60s. And the unions pushed for programs and benefits that strengthen the middle class. The power of unions has diminished since the 1970s. The power of business and financial interest groups has increased. And so I think even though populism, as we call it, is very attractive to the electorate, it doesn't have much support from people in positions of power because the pressures against doing anything concrete are very strong.
John in Milwaukee. Hi, John.
Hi. Yeah, I was somewhat surprised. I think you said that Chelsea was going to, Mrs. Clinton, Hillary, is going to combat Wall Street in the future if she got elected. And I can't see how that would happen when Chelsea marries a big executive of the Goldman Sachs Federal Reserve Bank. And another thing is the Clintons and the Bush family, if they would run against each other, this would be very great, because then you have the most corrupt political and economic forces in the country running against each other for president of the United States. And I think it would make a lot of people wake up and open their eyes and see what's really, really going on.
Well, it is kind of hard to believe that you would have the same two families who have dominated American politics for so long once again run against each other. Isn't that something, Professor Zelitzer?
Yeah, I mean, we are in a period where we're recycling the same
right.
names. Obviously, they're still very different candidates, and Hillary Clinton is certainly different from her husband, a different background, a different set of policies, I think, and could be a different approach to Democratic policy. And Jeb Bush, we don't know as much. I think the differences with the brother. I don't think the personal life of the candidate matters or dictates what they're going to do. We have to remember Franklin Roosevelt was one of the wealthiest presidents we've had and also one of the most liberal. So I think the family connections often don't give us a gauge in terms of what they're going to do in office. You can have very rich, progressive people. There's a whole history of this. And you could also have people who come from modest backgrounds who don't have sympathy for a lot of government. Richard Nixon was like this, and Ronald Reagan in many ways as well. So I think the bigger issue isn't the corrupt people. It's the system and the problems with the political system. And when we take our eyes off of that, I think that's why the problems keep recreating themselves, regardless of who's running at this point.
I don't know very much about Chelsea's husband. Is he a hotshot on Wall Street?
Yeah, he's a very big hotshot on Wall Street, a big investor. And I believe, and I might be mistaken, he's even had some interaction with the Clinton Foundation. But he's a very prominent figure.
And what about the investigation that Times had a big story, as you know, about the Russians and uranium and the Canadian mining company? It's very detailed, but it seems to me as though there are some areas here that might be very problematic for Clinton, who's going to be under intense opposition research.
Yeah, I think that, I mean, the foundation, in my mind, has always been one of the biggest issues she's going to have to face. And these stories that have come up in this book have been circulating for a while. They've even been in the media already, variations of it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's always been a question, how do the Clintons stay in politics? How does she run for the presidency after serving Secretary of State when you have all these donors giving money to this foundation? And I don't know how many of these are true. We're going to find out. I assume the investigations will continue. But I do think it brings up a certain aspect of her character that bothers people, and this is something she often faces. Is she someone who tells the truth? Is she the kind of Democrat that she says she is or wants to be? And how does the long history of the Clinton relationship with Wall Street, with big donors, impact their ability to deliver on traditional Democratic programs? And these are all always circulating with her, but I think this story more than others, including because it was picked up in the mainstream press, have brought some of these issues to light. And they will come back again and again in the next year or so.
Professor Julian Zelizer is our guest for a few more minutes, professor of history, public affairs at Princeton University, very prolific writer, many books on presidential history, including most recently The Fierce Urgency of Now, Lyndon Johnson, Congress, and the Battle for the Great Society. We have time to take a couple more phone calls. 800-486-8655 is our number. Stan is next in Caledonia. Hi, Stan.
Hey, just a quick question. What is your opinion of the fact that LBJ killed Kennedy?
Right, we're back to that.
Yeah, we're going to go on to Bob in Port Washington. Hi, Bob.
Hi. The center is missing. Things fall apart, and everywhere the blood getting tied is loosed. I mean, it's poetry, but I think it speaks to what's happening right now. I think we're losing our center. We're losing our sense of the public and a sense of connectivity with each other. And I think that these class divides that we're creating, probably the most profound one is the one that revolves around sort of the militarization of our culture. And I think some of this sprang from the 1947 National Security Act with Truman, and where we created this sort of infrastructure for the intelligence state that we see now that I think is really running things, despite what people think about Bush and Clinton and all the other stuff. I think really it's a bureaucracy of intelligence. And the problem now is that the local police forces, I mean, they all think that they're CIA agents or James Bond or Navy SEALs or something, and they're taking on, and they're getting funding for this as well. And they're taking on this aura of constant paranoia, and I'm fighting terrorists, and I'm fighting bad guys. And I think that for a local police force to have that kind of, you know, knee-jerk animosity and fear towards the people that they're supposed to be serving is a huge part of this issue. And I totally agree that this is a systemic problem and that we need to look at another poem. You know, when it came for the gays, I wasn't gay, so I didn't speak up. When it came for the Jews, I wasn't a Jew, so I didn't speak up. When it came for me, there was no one left to speak.
Professor Zelizer.
I think, you know, in terms of the militarization of the national security program, you know, it's interesting how hard it is to sustain the outrage on that. And I think there are many people who are uncomfortable with what's happened with national security, certainly since 9/11, including surveillance programs. But thus far, you know, after Edward Snowden and the anger that followed that, it's kind of faded as an issue. And this is where there is a bipartisan consensus. And the consensus is, let's not deal with that. And it's really been off the table. Rand Paul, we'll see if he brings it up. So far, he's actually been somewhat quiet on the issue, given how important it was. And the second part of the caller's question is, I think, relevant. And it's about how some local police units have been strengthened, have been bulked up with a more militarized approach to law and order as opposed to community-based policing. And that's one of those issues where we can look at what's happening in Baltimore and look what's happened in some other cities and ask questions, can we make policing better structurally so that these kinds of incidents are less likely to occur? And I think this should be a big issue in the campaign. I do wonder if the candidates in both parties are going to talk more about policing and criminal justice, whereas so far we've heard a little bit about it from Rand Paul, but it hasn't been central. But I think it's an idea whose time has come.
Mm-hmm. And we haven't talked about the Republicans at all. There are so many running that it's hard to give equal time to everybody. Do you see a breakthrough candidate at this point, Professor Zelizer, and when should we expect to see one?
We don't have a breakthrough candidate. It's a little too early. I think the figure everyone's looking at carefully is Marco Rubio. And Jeb Bush is the clear front runner, gaining the money and the nominations. But there are many Republican experts, certainly, and not Republican experts, who see Rubio as a real threat, as a very attractive candidate politically, someone whose personal story is very powerful, especially for the Republican Party after many years where part of the party has gridlocked progress on immigration reform. And he's getting some support now from some big funders. And so I guess he's the one I have my eye on at this time, as not a surprise candidate, but someone who might be more powerful in this competition with Jeb Bush than some people are expecting.
And Scott Walker?
Scott Walker, you know, he has appeal, and a lot of conservatives really like, you know, the fire in his belly and his anti-union positions, but he brings with him a certain level of controversy and an ability to polarize and energize his opponents that I think in the end might be a liability for presidential politics. So he also has all the investigations that took place in Wisconsin that, you know, I think those issues could come right back. They're dormant right now, but I don't think they've disappeared.
Thank you, Professor Zelizer, as always, for being with us.
Thanks so much.
Professor Julian Zelizer, our guest, he is a professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University. Latest book is The Fierce Urgency of Now, Lyndon Johnson, Congress, and the Battle for the Great Society. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, so that's what we have to say about that. I'm Kathleen Dunn, I'll say that, and Lisa Nalbandian is joining me in our studios here, and this is also our Wisconsin Public Radio Spring Membership Drive, and your support is an essential piece of funding for this program and for everything you hear on the station. The drive is the time for you to take some action and become a WPR contributor with your gift at WPR.org. 888-202-2552 is the number.
We're looking to get 36 more pledges in the next 7 minutes or so. Make your gift to support the WPR programs you enjoy and rely on each and every day. Your pledge right now at WPR.org or 888-202-2552 makes a difference.
I hope you know how wonderful it is to be able to interview people like Professor Julian Zelizer. He's been a regular for years on this program. He's so smart and so knowledgeable about presidential history and what's going on in the news. And this example, this hour, is an example of all of these informative political discussions that we have many times during the week. I love them.
You know, all the pledge drives that we've done in the past, like, made this hour right now possible and this conversation possible. And what we're doing now is asking you to help us support the future hours and the future conversations. Choose a gift amount that works for you, then make your pledge at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
And as an added incentive, we have something special during this spring membership drive. It's a 2015 WPR artist mug. It's very pretty. It's designed by Nick Robleski, an award-winning woodcut printmaker from the Driftless region of Wisconsin.
The Artist Mug series is a wonderful tradition, and this year's mug is just simply beautiful. It features two swans flying through a starry night sky. It's yours when you give $12.50 a month. That's $150 or more. Ask for your mug now. Ensure your support for WPR when you make your pledge at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
I'm Marcy from Madison, Wisconsin. I'm a sustainer of Wisconsin Public Radio. First of all, the word obsessed has been used with public radio. I've been listening to nothing but public radio for probably upwards of 20-some years. When I made a transition moving back to Wisconsin after being gone for 20-some years, it was a great way for me to sort of get back to what was going on, feeling involved. It was a great connection, and I think that's probably the word that I think of the most. I feel very connected when I'm listening to public radio. I'm a sustaining member because I don't have to think about it. Well, first of all, it's so easy. I don't have to do anything. I wish all my bills could just magically be paid that way. And although it's not a bill for what it gives back to me, it is something that I'm willing to pay for. It enriches my life. It's invaluable to me, so I'm happy to give back.
And you can pledge at WPR.org, 888-202-2552. We want to remind you the state budget is in the news a lot, and as proposed, the budget puts state funding for Wisconsin Public Broadcasting at risk. The state's investment has brought a wide range of public broadcasting services to Wisconsin, like preparing children for school, resources for K-12 education, and the ability to broadcast throughout the state.
Meanwhile, listener support, your support, keeps WPR programming strong. So thank you for your financial support right now at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
I'm Kathleen Dunn with Lisa Nalbandian, and we are asking for your support during this, our spring membership drive. Your gift might be $10 or $20 a month. Whatever you choose is great.
Maybe you can make a 9XM leadership contribution of $100 a month or more. Listeners who rely on Wisconsin Public Radio are the most dependable source of income for this station, and 9XM members are an important part of that picture.
Help us continue to grow with a leadership gift, WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
WPR is your daily companion. We're on the air 24 hours a day, whether you're at home, in the car, at the office, whether you're concentrating really hard on something or just simply relaxing.
And like a good companion, you count on us for accurate news, great music, and intelligent conversation. And we count on you to support what you hear. That's how public radio works. So give now, WPR.org, 888-202-2552.
Well, we're still looking for 36 pledges in the next minute or so. So pledge right now, WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
When you like what you hear, you should help pay for your public radio station and what you hear. You choose the amount, $5, $10 a month, a great starting point, or whatever is comfortable for you. Thank you so much for all of your support, Lisa. Thanks to you, and thanks to K.P. Whaley for producing the hour that you heard with Professor Zelizer, and to Katie Madsen for on-air production in Milwaukee. The number again for support is
888-202-2552.
Excellent. Or WPR.org. Thank you for all of your gifts. We need them.